Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. Before I introduce my guest, I just have to make a comment about some wonderful news that I got before the program began just a few minutes ago. And the news is that this program is growing in popularity, which is really wonderful to hear. The downloads are growing. The audience is growing. I hope the live audience is growing. Always a concern on weekends in the summertime when the weather is good and lots of people are out. But the people who are out and they want to listen, if they can't listen live, they can download the program and listen later, which is the wonderful thing about online programming. You can pick your time to listen no matter what time a program goes on. But let me just say this, the program's popularity is not about me. It's about the guests that I bring on, the topics that we choose, the major world and national topics, and maybe the promise I make that I will back off from nothing. You name the hottest topics, the most important ones, and they're likely to be discussed on this program. No punches pulled with top guests like my guest today and my guest tomorrow and the one on Thursday of this week and next week and the week after, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'll just use the phrase that my friend and director of Project Censored uses, Mickey Huff. He and Peter Phillips, the former director, they talk about a truth emergency. And that's a wonderful phrase that I wish I thought of. They did, and I've quoted them, a truth emergency. The need, well, the fact that it, in the dominant media, the major media, the corporate media, most of so-called public radio, you cannot get the truth, especially on the big topics. They will not tell it to you. That is an emergency. And because of what's going on now, I can't imagine a more important time that we all really need to know what's going on, because we are really descending fast into some very troublesome dark times. We need lots of people listening to this program and others like it to find out what's really going on. If we don't understand the problem, there's no way in the world we can even consider doing anything to take it on and solve it. And as I say all the time on this program, it's never going to come from the top down. They're the enemy. It's up to us from the grassroots. And we need a lot of people joining in, hopefully some powerful ones, some eloquent ones. Martin Luther King, where are you now? We need someone who can speak with that power to explain the dangers and get people aroused enough to want to change it. Well, let me introduce my guest today and another major topic for me, a brand new book. My guest is William Cook. Bill is a writer. He's an author. He's professor of English at the University of La Verne in California. He served earlier there as its vice president for academic affairs for 13 years. His books include Cultural Expressions of Evil and Wickedness, Psalms for the 21st Century, and his newest book titled The Plight of the Palestinians. Well, it's a special honor for me because Bill made me a contributor to the book. Bill is the editor. He's also a contributor. And there are extraordinary people contributing to this book, people who've been on this program. And even an earlier one that I hosted, like Alain Pape, James Petras, who's on this program, Jeff Halper, he was on another one, I will get him on this one. I know Jeff. I've interviewed him twice, one for something special unrelated to a radio program, and I do want to get him back, Palestinian professor. Oh, the departed Tanya Reinhardt. I read one of her books, extraordinary work. Sadly, she's gone much too young. Oh, and so many others. And, of course, Bill. He's a contributor, and he's the editor. The subtitle of the book is The Long History of Destruction. I don't know of any more core topic for me than what's gone on with the Palestinians since before 1948, Israel's so-called War of Independence. I call it what it is, one of the great crimes in history, and it goes on today. And once again, we have peace process talks announced. Bill, I want to welcome you, and let me just add one more comment. The bogus peace process starts up again. My goodness, I've written several times on it. A major article I wrote, I think it was early this year. This morning, Bill, before this program, I wrote another one, and I'm probably going to get it out tomorrow. I mean another charade, another mm-hmm. bogus peace process. I mean, even the New York Times is skeptical, Bill. If the New York Times is skeptical, this is a bunch of hokum.
I think, Steve, and welcome.
Welcome to you, Bill.
To the book and to the program, the new radio program, and thanks for having me on. I was going to say that Jeff Halper's piece in this book called "The Problem with Israel." That's 2006. This would be a footnote to it. One more in a string over all the years that he covers from 1948 to the present, where Israel has been the, what would we call it, the stoppage in preventing peace or even discussion of peace from taking place.
Oh, indeed so. I spoke to Jeff about his book. I want to get the title right that he wrote 2 or 3 years ago, An Israeli in Palestine. And he went over there 30-odd years ago. There was a great line from his book one of the lines I simply can't forget. When he went over there, he was from Wisconsin, and his mother said to him at the time, quote, "Israel is no place for a Jewish boy," unquote. Oh, how right she was. Well, it's kept Jeff busy all these years. And his issue began, professor of anthropology, his big issue at first was stopping home demolitions, but it went way beyond that. And he does important writing and exposing the great crimes that go on. And so do you, Bill. And this book is a marvelous achievement.
I'm hoping that it has enough influence to present at least some voices against what is the usual fare that the American population gets relative to Palestine and Israel.
Oh, it's pretty shabby, as we both know, and it's the opposite of what we discuss on this program. And this topic comes up all the time, Bill, occupied Palestine, the great crimes that go on all the time, whether it's something big like the last Gaza war, Operation Cast Lead, or the May 31 massacre in international waters, the Freedom Flotilla.
Actually, the Mariam is supposed to be leaving port today, I understand, although having been over there in Lebanon, expecting to be on its companion boat in late June, which never sailed. I'm not certain that the Mariam will make it out of port. There seems to be an incredible blockage of ways in which it is going to be cleared from leaving the dock. And so the same thing happens. There's a continuous threat, perhaps, to anyone that wants to demonstrate what amounts to democratic freedom of speech by becoming a member of a boat in order to go into Gaza through international waters, because the threat is always that if you are doing that, you are somehow a terrorist against the United States, because it is linked umbilically to Israel, and Israel claims that virtually anyone, including Lebanon as a country, Hezbollah, which is a part of the Lebanon government, or Hamas, are terrorists against Israel, and therefore anyone helping them is a complicit in that terrorism, regardless of the fact that the reverse is really what is true.
Well, that's right. It's pure Orwell, as you know, Bill. You know, war is peace, ignorance is strength. You know, peacemakers are terrorists, an upside-down world, and it really is appalling and outrageous. I don't have to explain that to listeners of this program. If we only could get the audience that CBS gets on cable, Fox News, the absolute bottom of the pit, an open sewer is one of the expressions I use to describe them. Ruben, if you don't like it, sue me. Mm-hmm. Sue me. You run an open sewer, and yet it has the highest ratings on cable, and their worst programs, the Glenn Becks, the O'Reillys, they have the highest ratings, and it's shocking. The people go there expecting to find out what really is going on, and this is the kind of garbage that they put out. I do also a fair amount of media critiques, Bill, so to some extent I do a little monitoring of what these people do just to see where they're going. I can't bear to listen to them or watch them, but I'd rather see something in print. And I can just use their own words and reports, pulling out some quotes and let them hang themselves. I wrote one article on Glenn Beck alone, and he made it so easy for me to just tear him to shreds. I just quoted him up and down and what he had to say. And one of his quotes was something like, anybody who takes what I say seriously is nuts.
Well, you're self-flagellating here, Steve. All good things grow out of suffering, and listening to Beck and Rush Limbaugh and company is essentially that. You are causing yourself to suffer.
Oh, you really do suffer, and yet you go to Limbaugh. I think on radio he has the highest-rated program. My God, what kind of people tune into this stuff? Don't they have any idea in the world what's going on? They may not be well informed like people who listen to this program all the time, but don't they have any idea in the world? There was a Limbaugh quote I used in an article about. I put out so many, Bill, I forget which one it was, but it was about one of the wars, either Afghanistan, Iraq, or maybe all of them. And his comment was something like, in the old days, the idea in wars was to kill people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I was talking about killing civilians, not combatants. You know, combatants go at each other and people get killed. Well, it doesn't mean the war is good, but that's what happens in wars. But when wars deliberately target civilians, and that's exactly what we do in ours. I think it was an article about WikiLeaks with regard to Afghanistan, and I used that quote about him, that we go around killing people. Most of them happen to be civilians, and he's saying, well, that's what wars are all about. What do you expect wars to be?
Well, that film that WikiLeaks released showing the helicopter circling over Baghdad and picking out a group of about 12 people, two of whom were Reuters reporters and photographers, apparently then carrying weapons, although they were cameras. And they have the voice from the cockpit saying, can I shoot now? Can I shoot now? I've got them in my crosshairs. And it's not a matter of who are you killing. It's a matter of I can kill now. And the speculation that perhaps they are terrorists, not knowing it, not thinking that there is need to confront whether or not they are, whether they're civilians, and as it turns out, even two children were in a van that came to help rescue somebody from the first slaughter, and they slaughtered them as well. This kind of thing is being shot from high up in the air at innocent people, and there's no presumption of whether or not they're guilty of anything. It is simply that they're not us. They could be the other, and therefore we shoot. That same kind of thing is happening in Israel, and they've reported on it, that the drones that go overhead are being shot at, being used and shot through the drones by IDF personnel, apparently mostly women, for reasons I do not understand, who are distant and do not see anything but the screen in front of them, and when told to pull the trigger, they pull the trigger. This is not unlike what happened at Nuremberg, when the defense essentially was, I do what I'm told. We've come a long way from an understanding of what justice is and what law is.
We sure have, Bill. And, of course, in Israel, the military service is mandatory for men and women. But the plain fact is that a lot of young men and women are opting out and refusing, I think especially women, opting out and refusing to serve. And when the numbers get too big, they can't throw them all in jail. Mm-hmm. I mean, Israel has laws that say if you don't fulfill your service, there are people excluded, like the Orthodox Jews, and of course, if you have a physical impairment, you can be excused. But otherwise, for healthy young adults, men and women, military service is mandatory. And I mean, they basically get orders to go out and shoot and kill and do whatever they please. And I want to stick with Palestine, Bill, and mm-hmm. and the book. But one more thing about the U.S., and I've quoted from it, we have conflicting rules. On the one hand, we have not only U.S. law and constitutional law and international law, we also have something called Army Manual, and I think all branches of the service have the same thing, the Army Wanted Field Manual 2710. And it states very specifically in there that you cannot commit an illegal act, and if the President of the United States orders you to do it, it is your obligation to say no. And then we have rules of engagement, and they've been operative for I don't know how long, probably going back at least to Korea, Vietnam, and the rules of engagement for Iraq, Bill, were shoot and kill every Iraqi military-age male, which basically means any Iraqi male you see who you think might be of potential military age, no matter how young mm-hmm. or how old, shoot him and kill him.
Which would seem to contradict what is stated in the field manual.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely contradicts it. And yet they get those conflicting orders, and we've discussed that on this program. I'm sure I will again. And this goes on and on. And as far as Israel goes, they simply want to eliminate the Palestinians. The rule of law is simply not in the vocabulary of the Israelis. And I truly believe that Netanyahu is the worst we've seen so far. I think he's even worse than Sharon, as bad as Sharon was. Sharon, when he was housing minister, they called him the bulldozer.
Mm-hmm.
The bulldozer. I think that's self-explanatory. And he committed the horrendous war crime in the 1982 invasion of Lebanon, when 18,000 people were killed thereabouts, and he ordered the extremist Lebanese militia into the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps to murder maybe 3,000 people. And he was criticized for it, but he got away with it and then became prime minister.
Right.
So their rules of engagement, Bill, are they were going way back to the beginning, 1948, and they certainly are now. Palestinians are evil. Shoot and kill them, men, women, children, makes no difference. Shoot and kill them. Get rid of them.
I spent parts of 3 days at the Shatila camp in late June into July, and see the conditions that exist now, 63 years after the fact, that are the most horrendous place for human habitation you would want to run into. These are cement bunkers, essentially cinder block bunkers that have been built over the years trying to accommodate a population growth that can't go outside the parameters of what the UN set up back in 48. And the result is that you have little narrow alleyways between whatever structures exist. The structures are homemade because they do not bring in contractors. They have no money. Until this past week, the Lebanese government took a vote which allowed for the opening of the door to Palestinians to work as out-of-country workers for the first time, which means that they can at least apply for certain jobs, restricted, understand, because Lebanese citizens are the only ones that are allowed in various and sundry professions and occupations. But at least there's a little glimmer of hope that they might be able to make some money. Lacking that, of course, what you see when you walk into the Shatila camp are these alleyways of filth and rubbish that has been piled or destroyed buildings that have not been cleaned away, homes that are stretching between them, stretched lines so people can hang something out to dry. A man walking around with a gun trying to spray the vermin that run through the place. It's an unbearable way in which people have to live, and these people have rights, and the major right they have, of course, is to return to their homeland under international law. It's not even a discussion in the peace process from the Israeli side, and we will find that to be a major confrontation point that Obama and Hillary Clinton are going to have to contend with, because the vast majority of those that are caught in these refugee camps have no country. They have no citizenship. They are people alone in the world, and the indifferent world has cared nothing for their condition, because in good measure, they'd know nothing about it. And that's why this book was put together from my point of view. I wanted the world to somehow understand that from the beginning, from the 30s and 40s, the intent of the Israeli Zionist group, a small group of people relative to the whole population who ran it like a mafia, the procedures of which were stunningly against any civil rights of Jews and or Arabs and or British mandate forces. And its intent was to cleanse the land. They didn't use that word. It is a nice word. They wanted to exterminate, get rid of, force out the indigenous population and take the land for themselves. This is an abominable situation, and yet we are linked to it. And what the book demonstrates in 32 chapters is that that same kind of processing of control by an organization with incredible wealth has managed to maintain an ongoing genocide in Palestine. And that, I think, from people around the world who are knowledgeable and who have detailed information and who have emotions and a moral premise on which they build to make that point clear. And that's what this book does.
Genocide is what it is, Bill. I've used the term slow motion genocide. The Nazis did it assembly line. The Israelis are doing it slow motion, but it's the same thing. And it's what Ilan Pappe uses. Francis Boyle, who has been on this program once, an advisor to the Palestinians. He called it unequivocally a genocide,
yep.
And he is an international law expert. And I mean, if he says it, he'll quote a chapter and verse from international law, the fine print. I can quote international law, but he'll quote that and quote all the fine print besides, and speak with the expertise of a guy who really knows this stuff. He teaches it. And he understands
yep.
it, and he knows this is genocide.
When I put this book together, I didn't know you, Steve, but I asked you for an article, Israel's Slow Motion Genocide in Occupied Palestine, back in 2008. And that particular article is really the beginning of the book, as it turns out, in a section called The Human Tragedy. And it points to the reality that you mentioned before, that citizens are fodder for the governments that are willing to control, whether that's the Israeli government or the United States government in our particular concerns. And then I asked you for another article, which came out in May of 2009, and that is the beginning article under Rule by Law or Defiance. That's part three. And it's on the Russell Tribunal. And I started that section with that article because I wanted the world to understand that regardless of what governments do, ultimately it's going to be the people that are going to take control when they realize that the governments are in collusion and that the procedures by which they've established international order, the United Nations, for example, can be thwarted at any turn by a veto of one country standing against the other 190 nations of the world. And they take that resolution every year, and it's essentially the same numbers. It is the world against Israel and the United States. Should they return to a just and meaningful peace where the Palestinians are granted their rights, including the right of return, and that one veto can destroy any attempt to make that happen. So we need groups that, like the Russell Tribunal, that's going to come out and at least deal with these issues so that the world can see that there is a way in which they should be dealt with, not the way that the governments that control deal with them.
Oh, so true, Bill. And the one time I interviewed Jeff Halper, unrelated to a radio program, was related to the Barcelona session that the Russell Tribunal for Palestine held. That was back, I think, around March. And Jeff, we couldn't get him live. He was not in Israel. He was traveling, and he happened to be in California, I believe. So I caught him when he was at a conference, and he was participating. And I got him when he was able to break away, and we taped about a 20-minute or so interview. And I did the same thing with two others in relation to that tribunal. And, of course, there's another. There's a Brussels tribunal that began by Bertrand Russell many years ago with regard to the Vietnam War and the one on Palestine. They're separate. They function entirely separately, but certainly one was the inspiration for the other. I'm a member of the Brussels tribunal. And very honored. I mean, it's an esteemed bunch of people that are the members, and I think they've picked up some of my articles from time to time. And it's just wonderful to be associated with something like that. It's so important, and you're so right, Bill. I've quoted the UN General Assembly, the vote that comes down. I think the world against the U.S. and Israel, and there are a couple of others. There are a couple of small Pacific islands that join in with Israel.
Well,
the
they
US,
joined, you
like
know,
a Palau or someplace, or the Solomon Islands.
Palau, that's right. And I think we support them so that they can exist on the island. And obviously they're going to do what we ask them to do.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Oh, for sure. They're getting aid from the U.S., so they do exactly what they're told to do. But at the same time, even though you get that vote, you get the entire West, you get the U.S., and you get the Arab states with only a few exceptions, either siding with Israel or simply dismissive of the fact that the Palestinians have been suffering so grievously since before, I mean, the 1947-48 war that began in late 47, but it really began before that. I mean, the plan was in. I mean, go back to Balfour when the British in 1917, I think, basically decided that they wanted a non-Arab face in the Middle East. And oil had been discovered. They didn't know how much then, but there was enough to want to get a non-Arab face there. So they decided that a state of Israel would be the way to do it. And it's gotten it's just gone downhill ever since. And the indigenous people, of course, have been the ones to suffer, and they still suffer today. And I mean, it's unimaginable what these people go through. People in the West. I mean, I write about it, Bill, and I cannot imagine what these people live through day after day after day after day, and they're on their own, and in plain simple English, most people who could help them if they wanted to, those people don't give a damn. Some indictment of the West and democracy, or Western civilization, what Gandhi said when he was asked, what do you think of Western civilization? And he said he thought it would be a good idea.
Yeah,
a great
it hasn't
quote.
Happened yet. That's for sure.
It hasn't happened yet. If this is what we call it, then please take me to some other civilization, because this is not the one I want to be part of.
The points you're making are addressed in a caustic little piece that's in the book by Robert Fisk.
Bill, can I stop you for just one moment? I hear the music in the background,
right.
And we need to take a quick bottom of the hour break. Hold that thought.
All right.
Let's pick up on that as soon as we come back.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Glenn Ford. Join me and co-host Nellie Bailey every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for Black Agenda Radio, an hour of news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. That's Black Agenda Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m. Please join us as we connect people, ideas, important information, and discover solutions to some of the most urgent problems facing us. Every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m., Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network.
This is an emergency. No, it isn't. It's an urgency. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com with a new show called News Dissector. It's built on the blog that I do every day for MediaChannel.org, dissecting news, analyzing what's happening in the world, offering very cool music and great guests. Thursdays, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Be there or be square.
This is Mark Rudd, host of Doing the Spadework, an ongoing conversation about organizing, talking with a variety of organizers from around the country who are out there doing the spadework, who are building the basis for the coming social and political movement, what you might call the new civil rights movement. Please join us each week to hear good conversation every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. Eastern, Progressive Radio Network.
Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
Back on with Bill Cook. We're talking about the brand new book that Bill edited called The Plight of the Palestinians. And Bill, you were about to cite one chapter. Let me let you pick right up and talk about that one.
All right. Well, the reason I wanted to mention it is that Robert Fisk, in chapter 20 of the book, it's called The British in Palestine, 1945 to 1948, A Conveniently Forgotten Holocaust. And he is citing here the fact that the British were literally at war with the Jewish agency, which they had established during the period of immigration into Palestine by the Jews from various and sundry locations, particularly Europe, believing that that organization would aid them in the settlement, resettlement of the people coming in. What they didn't understand was what is written about by Ilan Pappi in The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, where a consultancy, a high command of 11 or 12 of the Jewish agency personnel were in fact intentionally clandestinely at war against the British mandate. They wanted them out, just as they wanted the Arabs out. And the result is that when the British were under attack by the Jews in Palestine, they were captivated and concerned and wanting to accomplish something to change what was taking place against their own soldiers, who were the authorized authorities in the Palestine area. For example, this is a quote from his article, but in the late 1940s, all Britain was seized by war in Palestine when Jewish gunmen hanged two British sergeants, booby-trapping their bodies into the bargain. Britons were outraged. The British, it must be added, had just hanged Jewish militants in Palestine, but now nothing. Our dead soldiers hanged Jewish militants, our dead soldiers in Palestine, far from being remembered at the going down of the sun, are largely not remembered at all. Until 2 years ago, the campaign was never mentioned at the armistice parade in London. There's not even a definitive figure for the British troops who died. Around 400 were killed or died of wounds, and it took over 50 years for British veterans to get a memorial for the dead. In the end, the veterans had to pay for it from their own pockets. So the question then becomes, what happens to the facts of history? We do not get that information. What we get is a ragtag group trying to protect the incoming Jews who have a right to the land to settle. And in fact, their organization was at war with the British mandated authority. And so it takes decades before truth begins to unfurl. And what I was able to do in the book, and this is why the book came into being, I researched and found a file by Sir Richard C. Catling, who had been the deputy head of the Criminal Investigation Division in Jerusalem for the British Mandate authorities. And he had collected together and then housed in the Rhodes House Library archives of the Oxford Library System this file, which was classified, and it contained about 500 pages of appendices, each of which defined a problem which the British mandate authority had to face on a day-to-day basis in Palestine, because the Jewish agency had set up this clandestine second government, is what they call it. And the result is that he provides, through seized documents, documents that his organization went out and took. So these are words from the Jewish agency itself and its affiliated organizations, speaking to how they control the Jewish population, how they control the mandate government, and the terrorism. That's what they were doing. They were committing acts of terrorism, blowing up the King David Hotel, for example, putting a false flag operation into place where they dressed, and this is Menachem Begin and company, where they went in dressed as Arabs, leaving milk cans, only they didn't contain milk, and then blowing up the hotel, which had the mandate authority offices in it, and killed some 91 people. Kapling was there. He dived under the reception desk and survived that blast. But what you're dealing with is an intentional army against the British forces that had the authority and of the world organizations to operate how the incoming Jews would be settled in Palestine, and the Jews who were running the agency, the Zionist movement, had no intentions of following anything that had to do with the law that was in existence at the time. And so we're getting this from their words, understood by Harold McMichael, who was at the time a high commissioner there, and from Sir Richard Kapling, who wasn't a sir at the time, but when he returned, he was knighted. These people have left a legacy of what the facts actually were and the procedures by which they were carried out. And so in the introduction to the book, this information is presented, and it's presented in order to establish that the original intent was to cleanse the land of its indigenous population and control all of Palestine, regardless of the partition plan set up by the UN or by the declarations of the Balfour Declaration, which did not state that there would be a Jewish state, but rather stated that there would be homeland in Palestine for Jews. And His Majesty's government unequivocally denied any intent to create a Jewish state in Palestine. And that is established in the introduction to Part 3, Rule by Law or Defiance. It is that which then, with the 32 chapters devoted to what is happening in the first decade of this century, this 21st century, that establishes that it's an ongoing intent, and there is no relenting on it.
Oh, without question, Bill. And I've written a fair amount about Zionism, so misunderstood by Jews who think that this is the noble mission to get resolution from the Nazi Holocaust, that the Jews should have a homeland. And they simply have no idea, including intelligent people who should know better, but they don't, because they wear blinders and they won't make any effort whatsoever to find out the truth. But the true story of Zionism is, aside from the fact that they wanted a Jewish homeland, they could have gone one of two ways. They could have pursued it nonviolently or violently.
That's correct.
And they made a concerted decision that violence would be their way of going about it. And this guy, Zabotinsky, really, he became the most influential. And he got, among others, Israel's first prime minister, Ben-Gurion, to go with him. And they just decided that the strategy to be used against Arabs, I mean, they concocted this nonsense that Arabs are violent people. So the only way to deal with violent people is to be more violent than they are. Well, Arabs are not violent people, but they sure will, and they have every right to defend themselves if they're attacked. Mm-hmm. And I am less clear on international law before World War II. We certainly had Hague, and it said a lot about war and occupation and civilians and so on. But the law really got crystallized by the Geneva Conventions and Nuremberg and all the conventions that were enacted after that. And it's very clear. I mean, the right of self-defense is absolutely clear. The protection of civilians under occupation is absolutely clear. This is all unequivocal.
Mm-hmm.
And the Palestinians are not terrorists, nor have they ever been. They have the right to defend themselves. But as you know so well, Bill, the Jews who created the state of Palestine, including with incidents like 1946, I think, when they bombed the King David Hotel, that Menachem Begin, you mentioned Menachem Begin, a future prime minister, mm-hmm. he was head of the Irgun.
Mm-hmm.
They were terrorists. There's simply no question about it. They were terrorists. I think they would go back and admit that they were terrorists, and this was their strategy for creating a state of Israel. And it's amazing, Bill, that no matter what the Israelis did to the British Mandate forces, my goodness, they basically let them get away with it. And finally they pulled out, and as soon as they pulled out, bingo, Israel declared a state. And Harry Truman was the first president, the first state, to officially recognize the new Jewish state. And I quoted him from a brief statement that he put out at just maybe a minute after midnight, after Israel declared itself a state, and it was a two-liner or something like that, and there were a few words that he crossed out, and he wrote in his own words, but he wanted this country, the U.S., to be the first country to recognize Israel, and again, it's been downhill ever since.
Well, he gained a lot from that. He gained enough money to support a campaign for re-election.
That was the rumor. Is there substantiation for that?
Oh, well, he said himself that the Jews vote. I don't have any Arabs voting for me.
Oh, it was worse than that. The rumors were that he had interesting people visit him during the campaign with suitcases full of money.
There's a twofold set of letters. I wrote about it in an article that went to Harry. The first one came on May 14, seeking from him an immediate vote of recognition. And in that letter, it's very brief, from the Jewish Agency. In that letter, it states the United States will be recognized then as a country that has seen the value of voting for, I'm paraphrasing, the value for a democratic country in the Mideast, one that will adhere to all international obligations and laws and assure peace in the area of Palestine. At that time, a month before, you had the massacre at Deir Yassin on the very day, 1 month. And the result was that Harry was not told about Deir Yassin. There was no recognition of the terrorism that was operating against the British forces at that time. There was no attempt to show what the truth was versus the reality. Simultaneously with that letter, there was an advertisement in the New York Times and a couple of other major newspapers that established the virtues of creating the Israeli state, and no mention to the people of America that they were in the process of breaking international law as that ad ran. And the result was 418 towns and villages that were completely bulldozed or destroyed, virtually everything in them destroyed, with the exception of a few dozen, that were then, of course, made into Jewish settlements, and the landscape began to change. And that was the beginning of the Nakba, and it is described in great detail in a huge volume by Walid Khalidi called All That Remains. And in that book, You have the original populations by census, photographs of what those towns were like before the massacres took place, and then photographs after. And you have a complete population breakdown of the entirety of Palestine under the Mandate. And if you look at the cover of the book that I wrote, The Rape of Palestine, I have those four maps presented. The first one is in green with a couple of dots of white. The white were the Jews. But the whole land was occupied by Palestinians, and it was owned by them. And then you go to the 1947 November partition plan, and then you go to the 67 war, and then you go to now. And all you have now is a completely white area with some little speckles of green. And the anticipated, right now, state of Palestine could not, cannot exist. There is no means to link the existing populations of Palestine or Palestinians together, not only between Gaza and the West Bank, but within the West Bank itself, because it is crisscrossed by roads, highways that are built for 500,000 settlers and cut off from all access by the Palestinians who live there and own the land. And at the same time, you have a wall that has stolen an additional percentage of acreage for the settlers and for the Israeli country. And we don't know where the borders are anymore. It is simply an occupied, confiscated, security-fast land area that the Jews essentially own and control. And that is unfortunate because it is an inhumane process and an injustice to the people who owned and lived there from the very outset.
Such a gross injustice, Bill, and people who lived there, their ancestors, for centuries, it was their land, their property, and Israel enacted laws, a raft of military laws that basically gave themselves the right to dispossess anybody that they want, anyone living in it. Imagine in a U.S. neighborhood where authorities can come in and give you 24 hours to leave your home, and if you don't leave, they'll come in probably at a terrible hour, either 4 a.m. in the morning or it could be in the middle of the night. And if you haven't evacuated, you got your warning. If you're still there, they will bulldoze your home. It will come right down on top of you. They don't care. And under some circumstances, they'll even make the owners of their home and property literally pay for the Israelis to steal it from them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, talk about chutzpah, Bill. I mean, it takes chutzpah to a level that defies any definition of the term. And it's a wonderful term, but the way Israel abuses it, we need to find a new word and a new definition, because they go so far beyond the pale of what any even reasonably decent person could imagine.
Let me quote a passage from the Jewish Resistance Movement, March 25, 1946, which is very pertinent to what you just said. And this is the quote. But if the solution, that is, that Britain would not repeal the White Paper, is anti-Zionist, our resistance will continue, spread, and increase in vigor. There are precepts in Jewish ethics which oblige a man to be killed rather than trespass. The precept of defense of our national existence is at the head of these. We shall not trespass. Our resistance is liable to result in the creation of a new problem in this country, the British problem, the problem of British security in Palestine. And this problem will be resolved only by the Zionist solution. It would be better if the Zionist solution were proclaimed in recognition of the world a Jewish problem and the justice of our work in Palestine. We do not threaten. We only wish you to know our intentions clearly. How's that?
Oh, strong stuff. strong stuff. And it's amazing when the topic of Palestine or Israel comes up in the U.S. media, the major media, there's not a hint of any of this.
No, nothing at all.
Even the most outrageous events, as we both know, Bill, and we're getting near the end of the hour, even the most outrageous events, Cass Lead and the Flotilla Massacre, and the victims are literally labeled the terrorists, they're the bad ones, and Israel, the world's fourth most powerful military, nuclear-armed, another open secret, are they the victims? They're the victims, and civilians are the terrorists?
That's right.
And people believe this stuff. People actually believe this stuff. I mean, people in my own family, Bill. I mean, there are people in my family who won't speak to me because of what I do.
I would imagine.
Well,
let me go back to what we started the program with, which had to do with the militarization, essentially, of the state of Israel. Every citizen in that state, with rare exception, is obligated to be in the IDF. And as a consequence of that, they have a lifelong commitment to the security, if you will, of Israel. I don't know what the swearing-in ceremony is, any more than I really know what the ceremony is for the United States soldier. You quoted from the Army Field Manual, but then you also quoted from the Rules of Engagement. And there's a contradiction between those two. Back then, 1940, we had the Haganah, the Irgun, and the Stern. They were called gangs in order to de-emphasize the reality of their strength. And in this particular set of papers that we have from McMichael and Catling, there was a presentation of what the Jews themselves say are their numbers, all right? And you're looking at figures where these are trained people that come out of a variety of places, including His Majesty's forces. And you're talking of Haganah alone having between 60 and 70,000 men by 1945, and then add in the others. We don't get that. We get a ragtag army that is victimized by all kinds of surrounding Arab states. But to get into the Haganah, you had to take an oath. And I quote that oath in the introduction. And what's telling about it is its totality of acceptance and commitment to the high command, those who determine what the action of this new government that they intend to create, a new state that they intend to give life to, will be, how they will be committed to it. I hereby declare that of my own free will and in free recognition I enter the Jewish Defense Organization of the Land of Israel. I hereby swear to remain loyal all the days of my life to the Defense Organization, its laws and its tasks as defined in its basic regulations by the High Command. I hereby swear to remain at its disposal of the Defense Organization all my life. And it goes on.
We're out of time, Bill. Oh, I wish we could go on. Yeah, that ragtag army, it was a walkover for Israel in the 47-48 war. The ragtag armies came from the Arabs, who really had no interest in fighting that war at all, so they sent token forces in, and Israel literally had a cakewalk to steal Palestine for itself. My great thanks, Bill. We're out of time. The next program is coming on, so all I can do is again say thank you so much. The book is very, very important. The Plight of the Palestinians, extraordinary array of contributors, including William Cook. Oh, you've got to get hold of that book. And, I mean, I know the people who are in it, and we talk about this, and you just heard it. Get the book and read it all for yourself. Many thanks, Bill.
Thanks to you, Steve. Keep up the work.
And we'll be back Sunday, same time. Join us then. John Pilger, Gerald Celente will be on. Do join us.